Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Alexis Madrigal. Today, conversations about housing in our region and most cities revolve around gentrification as prices spiral up. When many people look back at the history of housing, they find the roots of our crisis in the government's role in redlining, mortgage discrimination, and segregation of the mid-century. But like Jim Crow, these policies were formally dismantled by the late 60s, and most histories stop there, with cities falling into crisis. Kianga Yamada-Taylor stepped into that research vacuum about the 1970s with jaw-dropping work that connects the frustrated dreams of the civil rights era to the disaster of the subprime mortgage crisis in our current era. Fresh off her MacArthur Genius Award win, she's coming up next on Forum after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. When Kianga Yamada-Taylor was born, her parents took a month to come up with the perfect name. And then they declared their intention for her in an incredible announcement of her birth. They wrote in part, "The Taylor Collective wishes to announce a Marxist-Leninist proletariat revolutionary has emerged in this historic epoch to aid in our struggle against capitalism, racism, sexism, colonialism, neocolonialism, and imperialism. Her name is Kianga Yamada." And you know, as she celebrates her MacArthur win as a socialist Princeton African-American studies professor and the New Yorker's most radical columnist, I'll be damned if they didn't speak it into existence. Taylor's groundbreaking book, Race for Profit, tells the story of what happened when redlining ended and capital began to flow into the inner city. She's also produced books on Black Lives Matter and the black feminism of the Combahee River Collective. And she joins us today to talk about her life's work. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Very happy to be here with you.
I couldn't help. The name announcement was so incredible. When I read it in a profile of you, I was like, we've got to put this into the intro.
Yeah, that is quite an introduction into the world and, you know, today. But thank you so much. I appreciate it.
In the 1960s and 1970s, the problem with American cities was not that too many white people were driving up prices, moving into black and brown neighborhoods. The urban crisis had nearly the opposite configuration. So can you tell us about the quote-unquote urban crisis of the 1960s and 70s?
Sure. I mean, the whole notion of an urban crisis that develops really in the era after World War II is really about looking at the ways that African Americans in particular had been locked out of not only the emergent spoils that came about through the war effort, but also through the exclusion from the social safety net that had been created in the United States in the 1930s. And a combination of those exclusions from both social provision from the state, as well as the kind of boon to the private sector, meant that cities where Black people were concentrated were undergoing enormous hardship in terms of not enough good-paying jobs. Jobs were moving to the periphery, to the suburbs for cheaper tax rates. Their housing was in a deplorable state. The U.S. government's policies from the 1930s had privileged building new housing in the suburbs. And that resulted in the deterioration of housing in American cities. And so as African Americans had continued to migrate from both rural areas, but also from southern cities into northern metropolitan areas, you know, they did not find the American dream that earlier waves of immigrant populations had found in American cities. Instead, they found what I describe, quoting Malcolm X, was an American nightmare. And that kind of exclusion and deprivation in the face of enormous wealth and prosperity what had been termed American affluence helped to instigate a series of urban uprisings in the mid-1960s that finally created or were an attempt to create, to force the American government to, for once, respond to issues of poverty, segregation, and exclusion that had defined much of the Black experience in cities over the several earlier decades. And so, you know, that conflict and those conditions were termed, defined as an urban crisis, but really what it was a crisis of American capitalism that was having its greatest consequence in the lives of ordinary Black people who were city bound.
Yeah. And out of that crisis, the response by the United States is, well, on the one hand, the Fair Housing Act, and on the other, the HUD Act. So lots of people sort of use the Fair Housing Act as kind of one end of the civil rights movement. You really ended up focusing on the HUD Act and how it worked in American cities. And you defined a kind of a term for what happened, predatory inclusion. So maybe you can walk us through that as well.
Sure. I think most people, including myself, were, you know, very familiar with the Fair Housing Act, kind of like the last, was believed to be the last signature legislation in the civil rights revolution of the 1960s. But I found, discovered through, you know, my studies in graduate school, something called the Housing and Urban Development Act of 1968. And I went on to discover that this, in fact, was the last kind of big legislation signed by Lyndon Johnson in August of 1968. It was 4 months after the Fair Housing Act, and that this was really the first attempt by the federal government to help low-income, working-class Black renters become homeowners. So the programs that had been created through the Federal Housing Administration in the 1930s that made working-class white people homeowners, that opened up the opportunity of homeownership to working class white people, of course, has now come to be understood as exclusionary and involving practices that have been described as redlining. And Black people were largely excluded from those programs. And so in the late 1960s, motivated by the urban uprisings that I referenced earlier, the federal government opened up homeownership to working class Black families under the idea, I mean, there were a couple of ideas. One was that, as Richard Nixon crassly stated in 1969, that if they own their own homes, they won't burn down the cities. And so many Republicans who backed this legislation believed that this was an opportunity to give Black people a stake in American cities, in the system more broadly construed. I think it was also signaled from the real estate industry that there was a market to be constructed out of the inner city, which is to say that the programs of the 30s that had incentivized the movement of white people out of cities into suburban areas had left an abundance of housing in American cities unavailable and that was unused. And so this became an opportunity also to turn Black renters into homeowners and to take advantage of that housing stock and to create a new market out of that. But one of the things that I look at is the way that the previous 34 years of neglect precipitated by government exclusionary policies degraded the housing stock in American cities. It meant particularly in Black neighborhoods that housing was distressed, It was old. There had been very little new building. And so now all of a sudden, those conditions that had been created out of the exclusionary practices of the state were now used as evidence to treat Black consumers differently, that those neighborhoods were determined to be risky. And so Black people could now become homeowners, but it would be on different terms than had been available to white people in the 1930s. And for me, that is what was constituted what I describe as predatory inclusion, is that the failure to actually address and repair the crises in housing created by government disinvestment over a three-decade period then meant that Black neighborhoods would were seen as subprime or seen as problematic in some way. And because of that, they were compelled to pay more to enter into the housing, to pay more to enter into the housing market.
And it's amazing because, you know, if you think about the local angle here, maybe the neighborhood that most defines this kind of movement in the Bay Area is West Oakland, where essentially most Black people were allowed to live during that post-war period. And the real problem became that there was so much stress on the housing because it was so overcrowded. And then you also had urban renewal, which destroyed a bunch of housing units as well. You know, let's call it 6,000 to 10,000 housing units in West Oakland. So that's the area in which these new homeownership programs go to work. So not new homes out in the suburbs, but these houses that have been really heavily used during a period in which overcrowding was, segregated housing was the norm.
Well, that was one of the things that I wanted to kind of draw attention to was, you know, one, that we often think of segregation as just an expression of the will of white people. Do white people want to live near Black people? Do they want Black neighbors? And, you know, that certainly is not unimportant in this discussion, but I think that, you know, one of the things that I wanted to look at were the financial routes to segregation and understanding the economy that developed around segregation. And this was key in the formulation of these programs was, you know, there was a willingness for the federal government to shift its policy. There was a willingness for the housing industry and the banks to shift their practice in the private sector. But it was all done with the kind of unspoken assurance that a new housing market for Black people could be built, but it had to be done so on a segregated basis.
Got to leave it there. We're talking with Kianga Yamada Taylor. She's a Princeton professor, a contributing writer at The New Yorker, and author of Race for Profit: How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Homeownership. We'll be back with more with her after the break. I'm Alexis Madrigal.
Hi there. I'm Rund Abdelfattah from Throughline. If you're listening to this podcast, you know that KQED produces exceptional storytelling that keeps you informed, inspired, and entertained. Their podcasts cover issues from your neighborhood to the entire country and everything in between. Support this work today.
You can help us continue to bring quality podcasts to your ears. Just head to donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Kianga Yamada Taylor, Princeton professor, contributing writer at The New Yorker, and author of Race for Profit: How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Homeownership, among other books. And we want to hear from you. Did you have experience of HUD's housing programs during the 1970s here in the Bay Area? And what role should the government play in housing low-income people? Call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. We'd love to hear your story about HUD housing programs in the 1970s. Or you can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Or you can email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Professor Taylor, one of the things that's really fascinating about your book is showing how we tried to use sort of a colorblind market approach to solve for low-income housing without actually redressing the racism of the real estate industry itself. And I was hoping you could talk a little bit about how you saw that playing out in the 1970s.
Well, I think this was a huge problem. The idea that, you know, there's legalized racial discrimination in housing up until 1968, and then the law changes, and it's as if nothing ever happened, right? There's no effort to redress or repair the damage that had been done to the physical property in Black majority neighborhoods, but also this idea that had developed.
Oh, I think we'll be trying to get Kianga Yamada Taylor back on the line. One of the things that she was addressing in the book was just that real estate appraisal itself, as it developed in the United States, was actually based on excluding Black people from real participation in the housing market. And it really came through and was institutionalized through American government policy. Like, if you take a look at the FHA in 1934 and the kind of underwriting guidelines that were used, they drew a lot on private industry's sense of what properties were worthwhile and valuable and what properties were not. And a lot of them actually lends right through the Chicago real estate industry, which had developed a pretty strict racial hierarchy in which sort of Nordic people's property was worth a lot and Mexican and Black people's property was worth very little. And when we can get Kianga Yamada Taylor back on, hopefully she'll be able to tell us a little bit more about how that ended up coming through into the 1960s and 1970s, where we do see that real estate appraisal, in fact, continues to value Black neighborhoods and Black homes at lower levels, which then changes the equation for everyone about what homeownership actually means. If your properties don't appreciate, then it's a very different thing to promote Black homeownership. Again, we'd like to hear from you. What was your experience of HUD's housing programs during the 1970s? We're talking with Kianga Yamada Taylor, who just won the MacArthur Genius Award. She's a Princeton professor and a contributing writer at The New Yorker. Give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Or you can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum. Professor Taylor, you're back. Just had to give a short monologue on real estate appraisals development through the Chicago School.
Okay, sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. So I'd love you to talk about that, the way that real estate appraisal has sort of systematically devalued Black neighborhoods and how that changes what homeownership means as a wealth-building vehicle.
So one of the things that, you know, I'm really sort of happy about with the book is the way that I really try to look at the practices of the appraisal industry, which I think until recently have largely gone, you know, haven't been looked at as much as they need to be as a factor in, you know, these shaping public perceptions that Black people have a deleterious impact on home values. And so, you know, I come to the conclusion that we really need to challenge this assumption that the promotion of single family home ownership is the most important or even possible way to end the racial wealth gap, because it assumes that black people owning homes has the same financial impact of white people owning homes, when in fact Black houses houses in Black majority neighborhoods have been grossly devalued. Andre Perry from the Brookings Institute is one among several people who've done studies recently that have showed that homes in Black majority neighborhoods, when controlled for everything else, quality of house and neighborhood and all those sorts of things, are devalued something to the tune of $150 billion less than homes of similar quality in white majority neighborhoods. And so this is, you know, not only does this mean that home ownership literally functions differently for Black people, most often more like debt accumulation than actually an asset accruing in value over time. But it should compel us to question, one, the role of home ownership in our society and why we have allowed this to become the vehicle through which we solve all of our large financial crises, whether it's a healthcare crisis, whether it's trying to finance your child's access to education, whether it's trying to have a dignified retirement. We have vested so much in home ownership, taking care of that, instead of thinking about socially, how does our society provide for that? How do we use our resources as a society to provide for those things, to take the onus off of our own individual ability to accumulate wealth in the form of a house? And so, you know, this is an opportunity really to think differently about what social provision is, what it should be, and how for Black people, home ownership is not a viable road to ending the racial wealth gap in the U.S.
And it's so interesting because I don't think people quite realize how different the American mortgage really is. Like, it's a specific instrument created through state intervention in the wake of the Depression and then sustained through the Cold War. And other countries don't necessarily do it this way. Instead, mm-hmm. this has been the U.S.'s version of wealth building for the masses. One of the questions I think your book really raises is, you know, shows that there are just many, many ways that U.S. government policy can be turned against Black people, particularly when sort of paired with the imperatives of the private market. But you also seem to want to keep a major role for the state. So what kind of apparatus do you think would be necessary to keep, you know, U.S. government policy for housing working for Black people?
Well, one of the things that I thought it was important to kind of write about is I wanted to push back some on the Richard Rothstein framework. Richard Rothstein, who wrote, you know, a very important book, The Color of Money, but I think overemphasized the role of government in creating segregation and in the precipitous housing crisis for African Americans in the U.S. And one of the things I wanted to look at was that it's not just a question of the role of the state, but it's really a question of the relationship between private enterprise and the state that is at the heart of these problems. When the federal government created its policies for the first time concerning housing in the 1930s, as they often do, who do they turn to help craft these policies? They turn to the private sector. They, you know, go to the housing and banking sectors and say, what are your best practices? What is your expertise that we can draw upon to increase the production of housing? Well, in real estate in particular, its best practices have always been tied to racism and racial discrimination. There is not a single moment in the 20th century where the real estate and banking industries in the facilitation of housing creation have not considered race, have not considered the exclusion of Black people as absolutely central to constructing for them a healthy housing market. Mm-hmm. And so for the state to then call upon the private sector to shape its policies, help to essentially suture those racist best practices onto public policy. And so one of the questions that we have to ask is, how do we get the private sector that continues to use race as a way to shape the market, as a way to imagine what good and bad neighborhoods are? How do we get the market and the private sector out of the production of housing for ordinary people? And that, you know, that's, you know, that it's we are so far down this road of the public-private partnership in the creation of housing that it's almost impossible to imagine not doing so. And so for me, the role of the government in this sense is that the state can play a huge role in terms of scale in providing housing, in creating affordable housing, and providing who need it, as we once did in this country, public housing, which turned into a dirty word, but is a word that we need to is a word and a concept that we need to resurrect. The state has the capacity to create housing on the scale that we need it in this country. We're in an insane housing crisis, and have been for decades, where we have this mismatch between stagnant salaries and incomes for people and ever escalating cost of housing, not just in the homeownership market, but for rentals as well. And so the only way that we can get out of that mismatch is to use the power and the resources of the state to provide housing.
And what do you, you know, public housing became a bad word in part because the sort of maintenance structure that went into a lot of public housing broke down, and public housing became in many places, not everywhere, but in many places, a place people didn't want to live. So from that history, what do you take as sort of the policy that would be necessary to sort of sustain public housing so that it didn't fall into disrepair again?
Well, the disrepair piece of that is so critical because it gets at the heart of the influence of the private sector. Why did public housing so quickly fall into disrepair? A big part of that had to do with the poison pill inserted in the legislation at the behest of the private sector, which was, we won't create a separate budget line for the maintenance and repair of public housing. We will draw the income for maintenance and repair from the rents that are collected. Well, what happens when the number of people begins to shrink who are eligible for public housing, where you're constantly changing the rules of eligibility for who can live in public housing because the private sector is breathing down your neck saying, we don't want government housing to compete with the private market. We want the public housing to be the housing of last resort. Then you've driven down the number of people who can live in public housing, which means that you have driven down the resources necessary to maintain and repair public housing. And so the whole issue with disrepair and the concentration of poverty was under the influence of the real estate lobby because they did not want a public sector competition in the private market. And so the policy, you know, again, gets to decoupling the private sector from the state in the provision of housing and then coming up with common sense policies, which is that the maintenance and repair shouldn't depend on the number of people living in the establishment. It should depend on what is necessary to maintain
keep
and repair a building.
Right.
And that isn't implemented in policy until the 1970s, when it's much too late, when the public stigma attached to public housing has already been set in stone.
I want to bring in caller V from Berkeley. Welcome to the show.
Hi. My feeling is that this is by design. I lived in, and the design is to force the gentrification in black neighborhoods. The housing policy, I think, has fostered gentrification, and I don't think it's an accident, because black neighborhoods were neighborhoods that had, we lived in the city. Those neighborhoods were close to public transportation. They were close to entertainment, and they were close to freeways. But now those neighborhoods are being gentrified, and the people who built them, who created them, made them cultural, are now being pushed out. And my feeling is that, as she is talking about, this was by design. This was the whole goal of urban renewal anyway, was to move black people out of choice land.
Thank you, V. Kianka?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, it's not necessarily by design, but it is the logical outcome of a kind of laissez-faire housing market, which we have in the United States, which is where there are no rules that regulate, really, the entry of private money to try to remake any properties or lands in ways that turn the biggest profit, that make the most money. And so when there are no real rules governing that, and certainly no rules that defer to the housing needs of ordinary people, then this is the predictable outcome. And this is part of a predictable pattern that has happened in cities over and over again, where space becomes, you know, ways that can very quickly generate capital. I mean, this is the secret sauce to housing, is buying low and selling high. And I think that, you know, those practices have been in place in one form or another over the course of the 20th century, and we're seeing their intensification now. But they've been called urban renewal. They've been called urban homesteading. They've had different names, but it's been the same kind of practice over and over again. And without protections for ordinary people, then they are the ones who are constantly moved to the periphery.
We're talking with Kianka Yamada-Taylor, who's just won the MacArthur Genius Fellowship. She's a professor of African-American Studies at Princeton. And we want to hear from you. What was your experience of HUD's housing programs during the 1970s in the Bay Area? And what role do you think government should play in housing low-income people? Give us a call now at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions and comments to forum@kqed.org. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for more Forum after the break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Alexis Madrigal. We're talking with Kianka Yamada-Taylor, who's just won the MacArthur Genius Fellowship. She's a professor of African-American Studies at Princeton. Something I really have been wanting to ask you, really for like a couple years now, is how should we think about the current kind of gentrification discourse? Do you think that that's still kind of the most useful frame for what's happening in cities? Or does your work suggest some other way of talking about or writing about, thinking about urban change right now?
I think that gentrification, like a host of other words like neoliberalism comes to mind, are words that get used a lot, and probably to such a degree that they begin to lose their meaning for people, and they can come to stand in for all sorts of practices and things that people rightfully want to point out that are wrong or unfortunate in a city, but may lose their poignancy in pointing out specific issues. I mean, I think that there are tremendous issues that we face in cities right now, and the moving out of poor and working class people is a huge one. The kinds of investments that are absorbing housing, where, you know, you have multinational corporations and hedge funds that are buying up all sorts of housing to take them off the market, to use them as places to hold on to money, is one aspect. I think the climate crisis is, you know, been seen abstractly, but I think in cities is becoming a understood as a different kind of phenomenon. I think the recent flooding in New York City and Philadelphia, like downtown Philadelphia, was underwater. I don't know if people realize that. I live in Philadelphia. It has created a different kind of urgency around these questions that I think we have assumed are not necessarily urban questions, or not necessarily questions about cities. And so I think, if anything, gentrification helps to focus on a narrow but important aspect of a certain thing that is happening in cities, but not necessarily the total picture of what you describe as a change that is undertaking, that is being undertaken in cities, that I think is multidimensional, and that, you know, we need to be able to understand in different kinds of ways, and not just a kind of singular focus on the issue of gentrification.
Yeah, and I think, you know, around here, I think so often it's like sort of the cultural markers of gentrification rather than the sort of underlying market forces that have been unleashed on neighborhoods for, you know, decades. And then a coffee shop pops up and it's like, the coffee shop probably wasn't one cause of gentrification. It was several decades of government policy interacting with these private companies in the real estate market. I want to add Pamela from Sacramento into the conversation. Welcome.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, sure can, yep. Pamela. Go ahead.
Great. This is an amazing conversation. I just happened to be in the car and I turned this on, and I'm so excited to be having this conversation. And, you know, the young woman that won the fellowship, that's amazing. I can't wait to, like, talk to you in person. But, yeah, I just want to let people know that I am a property manager by trade. And so I work a lot in low-income, you know, subsidized units, rental units. And, you know, when I was putting in the rents, I noticed, well, like, you know, the low-income person would pay, like, $460. And then I had to put in the other money. I said, wait a minute, that's market rate. The other money came from the government. That's why it's called subsidized. So the developers are actually getting their full market rate, by the way, number one. Number two, they get incentives, tax credits, and everything to purchase or to rather develop low-income rental housing, subsidized housing that we pay for with our tax dollars. But guess what? Those are all investments. Those are investors, like the woman was saying. Hedge funds, you know, they invest in actual low-income housing. And the reason why they make them look so beautiful is because, guess what? It's a 20- or 30-year contract that our government makes with them, that they have to subsidize that for 20 or 30 years. And guess what? After that, they can go to market rate. So we just paid off their mortgage, and Black people have been paying off the mortgages of white investors for, you know, hundreds of years, and still continue to do it. So one of the solutions is to allow regular people to actually own those low income rentals and do them.
Sorry, lost Pamela there, but I think we had just gotten to the point where we really needed to get. Yeah, that was incredible, Pamela, as a description of the mechanics of this low income industry right now. You know, her suggested solution at the end there was that we would allow ownership, or we would promote ownership. But that's actually one of the things that your book really tries to grapple with, like, on a net basis, Do you think that home ownership by low-income Black people is a good thing, or is there something else that should be done instead?
Yeah, no, I think it's, I don't think it's a good thing. I think that this was tried. I mean, one of the, you know, you can't write about everything in these books, and the HUD Act was a huge omnibus bill that had many different programs, but one of them was a small kind of boutique program that tried to encourage public housing tenants to purchase their units. And this was a program that actually got some traction in Mississippi. I think it was Mississippi alone in getting, you know, poor Black families to buy their public housing unit. But again, for me, this highlights how ownership and home ownership is conceived of differently for African Americans in this kind of example than for white people. Because what does it mean for a Black family to own a public housing unit? I mean, that can't possibly be any kind of pivot towards asset accumulation, towards wealth accumulation, towards doing anything except stabilizing your place to live. And so, you know, at the end of my book, the epilogue, I think, is titled Against Home Ownership. And the point isn't to that housing discrimination is okay, that we shouldn't comment anymore about the gross disparity between Black homeowners and white homeowners, but is to really look at what home ownership is supposed to, the work it is supposed to be performing in our society, and to suggest that perhaps our society could perform that work and not burden the individual with accumulating the necessary wealth to sustain themselves. That if college education were available and accessible to people without going into enormous debt, if you faced a healthcare crisis, that healthcare itself was available, was a publicly provided good. If retirement, you know, you were guaranteed a dignified retirement, if all of these things were taken care of socially, would we be so individually invested in owning our own home? And, you know, I think part of this is the misconception that, oh, people own their own homes and they stay there forever. They don't. Americans on average move every 5 to 6 years. The home is seen as an investment that you can cash in on, that, you know, you can use in that way. And what I'm suggesting as a provocation is not that discrimination is fine, but can we think of a different kind of way to organize our society so that we are not so vested in home ownership individually as a way to circumvent what otherwise might be social provision?
Yeah. Want to get to a few comments. Just wanted to say one thing. It seems like as long as the real estate appraisal and real estate markets, generally speaking, make prices go up when white people move in and prices go down when Black people move in, that it just seems fundamentally unfair to continue basing wealth in America on that system, as long as it has those dynamics. John writes, Professor Taylor's description of how the government should be proactive in its role in public housing makes me think about progressive demands of the infrastructure plan being considered by Biden. Sean writes, I live in Hunters Point, and I see a lot of homes around us only recently gaining value as developers move in to build on formerly industrial lots and bring quote-unquote new residents into the community. How much are market forces, such as what people are willing to pay for a home in this or that neighborhood, a factor in holding down prices in African-American communities?
I'm not sure I fully. Can you repeat the last part?
Yeah, sure. I think the question was basically, how much is this like the market? Let's phrase it like this. How much is this the market, and how much is this racism? If those two things can be disentangled.
Oh, and holding prices down?
Yeah.
I mean, what is the market? Like, this is, you know, people, we think of this idea because it's promoted by the private sector and, you know, the government itself, that the market is this kind of freestanding thing that, you know, is just determined by supply and demand. And that's not true. The market is a reflection of what we value. You know, the market is in many ways, you know, it's a reflection of our society. And so it's impossible to disentangle questions of race and how race factors into what is considered valuable. I mean, to this day, the most valued real estate in the single family home market is the white exclusive neighborhood. And this is why you continue to have hysterical reactions to over zoning issues and over the placement of multifamily dwellings and not just, you know, single family markets, but in proximity to white neighborhoods. And this is, it's impossible to extract the questions of race from how those market dynamics and reactions are shaped, because they are what is actually constituting the market itself. Like, what we conceive of as the good neighborhood, as the bad neighborhood, is absolutely completely infused with racial logics.
Let's bring in Cedric from Fairfax to the show. Welcome.
Hello. Yeah, I agree with the doctor that this is just a white supremacy problem, period. Everything else is just semantics. It's a talk of a free market. It's just propaganda. It's fantasy. As a matter of fact, I believe Frederick Douglass said years ago that just because we defeated the South in the Civil War does not mean white supremacy itself was defeated, and we would have to wait and see what it would morph into. And it's very agile at exploiting people of color. But I had a question. Mm-hmm. Throughout this period, the HUD period, the 30s, the 40s, the 60s, and 70s, what was the role of black banks?
That's a great question. This is, you know, there is an effort underway in the 1960s by black real estate agents and by black mortgage bankers to break through the walls of segregation. Because as I mentioned earlier, there's a recognition that with white people moving out of cities, that a new market and new market possibilities are developing in cities. And so black real estate operatives and black bankers want a piece of this market. And so, you know, in places like Chicago, there are, I write about a person named Dempsey Travis who helps to lead, you know, a boycott and protest demanding that black mortgage bankers be given capital from larger banks so that they can begin to lend to black families. And this is accelerated through the HUD Act in 1968, because now we have low income home ownership programs that make many more African-American families eligible for home ownership. And so what is interesting that happens in the wake of these developments is you begin to have some African-Americans who speak out against some of the they're not anti-segregation measures, but who are concerned about black people moving to suburbs because the concentration of black people in cities also is part of what is constituting this new market. And so if black people are just moving, black people with means are just moving into suburbs, then what will it mean for black real estate operatives who can't operate in the suburbs because of the racial discrimination that they have faced as
and Black politicians, as you've noted,
yes.
also.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So there becomes an interesting contest over how to deal with Black suburbanization and issues of segregation in cities, because that is the basis for Black political power, but also economic power, the concentration of Black people in cities. And so this becomes a very fraught issue in the 1970s.
You know, with our last couple minutes here, I just wanted to ask you, last minute really,
sure.
What capacity is the U.S. really lacking in making major housing interventions?
I mean, I think it all comes down to the influence of the private sector. We have had a conception of housing as under the dominion of the private sector for almost the entirety of the 20th century and certainly now into the 21st century. And as long as that is the default logic, that we leave it up to the private sector to produce housing, then it means that, you know, that will continue to pervade. And the role of government, you know, is being seen as just to provide the incentives and sometimes the capital for the private sector to operate in the housing market. And so it has taken itself out of the dimension, which, as we see, is quite dangerous.
We've been talking with Kianga Yamada Taylor, who just won the MacArthur Genius Fellowship. She's a professor of African-American studies at Princeton, contributing writer at New Yorker, and the author of Race for Profit: How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Home Ownership. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. I'm Alexis Madrigal. Stay tuned for another hour of Forum Ahead with Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.